Debbie Price. Welcome to Country Breakfast on RN. The death of a thousand cuts for Victoria's food bowl, the Goulburn Valley. For years, orchardists have been struggling against cheap imports. Fruit trees have been abandoned, farmers gone broke. And now, without government assistance, Australia's largest fruit processor, SPC Ardmona, says it may well close. The message from farmers to the federal government for not co-investing in the company is clear.
Utterly gutted, demoralised, very bitterly disappointed. What else can I say? I really hung my hat on this decision because it would have been a brilliant co-investment.
So are we going to lose yet another food processor? That story later on A Country Breakfast. Travel the country with our rural reporters, but before that, let's find out what's been making news this week. Good morning, Tony Allen.
Well, hello. Let's talk SPC first. And as you mentioned, SPC, which is owned by Coca-Cola Amatil, a multinational, wanted $50 million to upgrade its plant, for $25 million from the federal government, $25 million from the state government, which was contingent on the federal government agreeing to make it pay its money. So the federal government said no this week, and the future of hundreds of jobs at the cannery and the orchards that supply it are at risk. Now, Shepparton is bemoaning the decision, as we will no doubt hear later, but the community is still hopeful that even if the factory closes down, the region has a future. David McKenzie, the chair of the Committee for Greater Shepparton, that's a group that's been established by private citizens to lobby for the town's future, says there's a strong prospect about growing fruit and vegetables in the region, even if there is no cannery. He says the committee has approached vegetable growers at Werribee and Bacchus Marsh, who were threatened by Melbourne's urban sprawl, to move north to the irrigated Goulburn Valley.
The natural advantages we have here for the production of food are really quite unique, not only on a national level but on a global level. We've got great opportunities here, and we need to just catch our breath, absorb this, and then reboot and recognise that the world is our oyster.
Yeah, not as easy as it sounds, because I know in Werribee a lot of those vegetable producers have been hoping for residential zoning so that they can make a lot more money out of their land, but that's yet to happen. What about the politics of this decision?
Well, it's interesting. Well, agri-food consultant David McKenna has been looking at it, and he says, ironically, economic conditions for food manufacturers are actually improving. Coles and Woolworths have recommitted to buy Australian, and the dollar is falling, so that all helps them. And he says the federal government might end up spending $50 million in the Goulburn Valley anyway if SP Ardmona shuts.
The flow-on effects to that whole industry, we're not just talking about the people in the factory, we're talking about the growers, the transport companies, the packaging companies. So it will have a major impact on the Goulburn Valley. And the issue is it better to give $50 million to make the factories more efficient, or is it better to give $50 million in social welfare? And that's really a trade-off that has to be made, because that's really what it gets down to.
And a lot of the people in Shepparton, the growers too, are disappointed in the National Party. They say the Nationals should have stuck up more for the factory. But their leader, Warren Truss, who's also Deputy Prime Minister, says the supermarkets have a key role in the future of SPC.
Coles and Woolworths, the two biggest retailers in the country, say they're going to buy product from SPC. So that's about the best assurance you can have of tapping the Australian market, irrespective of how much competition there might be around.
Yes, you can't help but wonder if it had been a different story in a far more marginal seat. It is, of course, a very safe Liberal seat at the moment. So, Tony, what's the opposition said about SPC Ardmona?
Well, Joe Hockey is the target of Labor's criticism. They think he's the person, more than anyone else, who is anti-government assistance for the industry. SPC's parent company is Coca-Cola Amatil, and Mr. Hockey says that the company can afford it's to fund its own factory upgrades without help from taxpayers. But Labor says, through its industry spokesman Kim Carr, the government should be more patriotic about Australian manufacturing.
Joe Hockey has a merchant banker's view, particularly popular in the North Shore of Sydney, about the way in which the international economy works. The fact is that companies don't have to invest in Australia. They can choose to invest elsewhere. And if you leave these issues to the market alone, there's no doubt the market will decide the issue, but it won't be in Australia's favour. Governments have to fight for jobs.
We've been hearing a lot on Country Breakfast about coal seam gas, and the industry's not impressed with the New South Wales government.
Yeah, well, last year the New South Wales government put out a list of areas that it would try to protect from coal seam gas activity, including buffer zones down residential areas and protecting some wineries and horse studs as well. Well, this week they finalised the zones, and a lot of them are in the, around the Hunter Valley in the state's northwest. And it means that CSG activity will be banned in those areas, and critical agricultural areas like wineries and horse studs will be protected. There's some debate over whether the protection's enough, but the coal seam gas industry is not at all impressed. Paul Fennelly from the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association says New South Wales has gone about it completely the wrong way and Queensland offers a better policy.
This is an industry that now has agreements with 4,000 landholders in Queensland. A total different approach. There's a perception that it's like a biking gang coming into town. These people work very well with local communities.
And others think there's no stopping them.
Andrew Gregson is the outgoing chief executive of the New South Wales Irrigators Council, and he's taking up a job with a tobacco company. But his parting message to farmers was they don't have a chance in hell of stopping coal seam gas. He was very involved in negotiations with governments over the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, but now he says the focus needs to shift over what role coal seam gas is going to play in irrigation communities. And he thinks activists who oppose all coal seam gas activity won't get very far by putting up a brick wall to gas.
Particularly when you see both sides of mainstream Australian politics supporting the gas sector and its development. I'll be very clear in this answer. This is my opinion and not on anybody else's behalf. I don't think you got a chance in hell of stopping the development of a gas and mining industry in Australia. You need to find a way that it is adequately regulated so that everybody can continue to peacefully and profitably coexist.
Well, you certainly don't have a chance in hell of stopping the cyclone, although Cyclone Dylan could have been worse.
Yes, farmers and fishermen in North Queensland were very worried about the cyclone, quite understandably, but they seem to have got off pretty lightly. The heaviest falls of around 500 millimetres were recorded west of Mackay. But the farmers on the coast got away with rain totals of around about 50 mils or less, and the winds weren't too bad either. And so they're rather pleased, and for some of them they appreciated the rain. And that rain is now hitting over the mountains too, so hopefully it'll land in some of the dry cattle areas. And the fishing fleet too in the Coral Sea is pretty happy. The barramundi season starts tomorrow, and the barramundi fleet Townsville are looking forward to getting out there on the water. Karen Collard from the Queensland Seafood Industry Association says the fishery's been closed for 3 months. They had a very bad season last year, so this year they're keen to get their nets out again.
Well, they've been in port since November, so they're all chomping at the bit to get to work and put some barra on some plates. Some fresh water into the ocean is always a good thing. We seem to get some good catches of all species of seafood when we have some fresh water come in.
Now, just to put that 500 millimetres into perspective, the average annual rainfall for Melbourne is 600 millimetres. So they got most of Melbourne's rainfall in one day. Speaking of rain, and it looks like it's only going to get warmer and drier.
Well, weather modelling is a very complicated science, and the conclusion of the Weather Bureau at the moment is that there is an increased chance of an El Nino system developing later this year. This would bring warmer and drier conditions to Eastern Australia, which does not need warmer and drier conditions at all. The Bureau says most climate models indicate the tropical Pacific Ocean is warming, and that's an El Nino sign, and some models say we could approach the El Nino thresholds by early winter. So the Bureau's Andrew Watkins, in summary, says neutral weather, in other words, normal average weather, remains the most likely scenario, but an El Nino is possible.
They definitely have upped the risk of an El Nino event occurring in 2014. A bit early to put a number on exactly how much that risk has increased. At the moment, you would say neutral is the most likely. El Nino probably not too far behind, and La Nina is the least likely scenario for 2014.
Well, that's not very cheering news for farmers in New South Wales.
La Nina is the cold, wet version, so that's the least likely.
Now, it's tough enough when you lose a limb, but it's pretty tough if you're a farmer and outside doing very physical work.
Some unusual research from the United States from the Northwestern University, which looked at farmers who'd lost their limbs in accidents and whether the prosthetic limbs that they were given were suitable. The finding was that they weren't durable and comfortable enough for farm work. Farmers struggled to be comfortable with prosthetics in hot weather. Some of them got jammed up with dirt and sand because they're working outdoors, not just in an office, and they need better prosthetics probably than what they're given. Associate Professor Stefani Fattoni also said that farmers were found to sometimes use the prosthetics not the way they were intended, in rather unusual ways.
Climbing up and down tractors and jumping off of higher levels onto their prosthetic feet, going over uneven terrain. Those sorts of things challenge the durability of the device. Using their prosthetic arm as a hammer, because it's easier to do that than to go and find a hammer, and then holding a hammer is hard, so the prosthesis works just as well.
Innovation, I suppose. Now, most people probably don't really know that not only is it the Chinese New Year, but it's the Year of the Horse.
It is, and the celebrations are going to go on for a few days, and one of the winners are Australia's tropical fruit growers, because the Chinese like colourful fruits, very popular for the celebrations, and in northern Australia, one of the ones they like is dragon fruit, which is really an Asian fruit, more likely to be found in places like Malaysia and Vietnam. But they do grow them here in the Northern Territory, and grower Marcus Carlson says he's had a great season for dragon fruit and he's very pleased that his fruit arrived on the markets just in time.
We're lucky the truck was late on Thursday last week, so we got a few pallets on and they arrived this morning to a couple of the markets, but it was only a few pallets, but it was giving them a chance to get some dragon fruit.
As someone who's far more travelled than I, Tony, what are they like?
Well, they look quite spectacular, but when you open them up, they sort of look like a kiwi fruit, except they're white inside. And I don't reckon they taste of all that much, but we had a bit of a debate in the office and some people liked them and some people didn't, but they do look fantastic.
Thank you, Tony. Tony Allen with this week's Rural News. Rural Reporter is next.
Hi there, Geraldine Duke here, hoping desperately you can join us for our first February Saturday Extra. We're talking to some major health specialists about the plans always re-examined as New Year's start. How would our systems manage if a genuine modern pandemic started to rip through our world? It's a globalised one, and pretty good news for viruses and pathogens, especially in our region. So we'll bring you right up to date, plus a full-throated history of Australian surfing. Please join us Saturday Extra after 7:30 here on RN.
You're listening to A Country Breakfast on RN. Let's get out and about with our rural reporters. We return for the New Year program with a special report from Burnie reporter Jane Ryan, who saddled up for the annual saltwater muster, walking a mob of Wagyu cattle from Robins Island across to Tasmania. We'll find out how chooks keep their cool in a heatwave and join an exercise class in northwest Queensland that's looking after both the physical and social needs of local ladies.
To me, it wouldn't matter if I was just here by myself. I would still be exercising, but I just put it out there every week. I put a notice board down the park that we do the classes here for free.
Pumping it prairie style later in the program, but we begin today on a beach in northwest Tasmania where a droving tradition is being kept alive.
It's about a kilometre and a half across to Robins Island, which doesn't sound like much, but we have a 3 metre rise and fall in the tide every day, so it keeps it very interesting and very dynamic because everything we do revolves around the tide.
John Hammond is part owner of Robins Island, just off the northwest coast of Tasmania. G'day, I'm Jane Ryan, and this year I'm helping John and his brother Keith bring their herd of 1,500 Wagyu cattle off the island. It's an annual event, and it takes about 25 riders to push the cattle through 3 saltwater channels and onto the main island of Tasmania. What are Wagyu cattle like to move?
A few years ago, we actually, instead of bringing the calves off with their mothers, we weaned them on the island, and we did have a lot of trouble with those weaners. with their mothers, it'll be just like moving a group of dairy cattle, basically.
My name's Stuart Ablett. What I'm doing here is helping Hammonds bringing cattle off Robins Island to Tasmania. Sort of done that for many years now, so it's a nice sunny day, so I thought I'd better do it again.
I'm Tanya Ablett, obviously doing the same thing as Stuart.
Done a lot of stock work over the years, and it's just something that's in the blood, I suppose, yeah.
And I'm Gary McGowan, and I'm doing the same. We're bringing the Wagyu off the island.
The weather today is perfect for what we're going to do. It's overcast, there's a bit of breeze blowing, so when we bring the cows and calves off the island and head them into the channel, they're going to have the breeze in their nose, so they're going to walk into it, which is going to make it easy for our job. And it's going to keep them cool, because like 800 cows and calves, you can hot them up pretty quick if they get running around, so hopefully that'll keep them cool. And hopefully when we cross the channel, if John Hammond's got the tide right, which being an American, it does happen now and again, they do get it wrong, we will either be walking through 2 foot of water or we could be swimming through 10 foot of water. It's just dependent how he's timed that. But at the moment, I think he's got everything right. He's got the weather right, so he's been talking to the weather gods, and at the moment, it is really just a perfect day for cattle driving.
Have you got a life jacket?
Yeah. That's the
other thing. Come off it!
So we do have a little rubber dinghy in the channel that's going to pick up those people that do come off, so you could be one of them.
Thanks for the vote of confidence, guys. Well, here we are. I'm sitting on the top of Boof. Everyone told me he was lazy, but he's pretty frisky, actually. And we're heading down the road towards the Robins Crossing. We are going to collect 800 head of Wagyu and bring them back through the surf.
We're on the beach, we're looking across the Robins Island. I can see a group of swans over there, and just beyond the swans, there's normally a set of rocks we can see. When they're sticking out, there are tide rocks, so they tell us that it's shallow enough to drive a vehicle across. Can't see them at the moment, but by the time we get into position, it'll be, you know, good for the cattle. The end of a beach which is right next to the Montague campground, and just across the road is our Montague farm. We've got about 600 acres there, and that's where we'll leave the cows with the calves overnight, and then tomorrow morning we'll start yarding them about 9. It'll probably take us 3 hours to draft all the calves off, and the plan is to have the cows back on the beach at midday. Plan being to take the cows back before they realise the calves have been pulled off them.
It's incredible to look out over the channel crossing now that the sun is setting. The tide is in and Robins Island looks very small and far away with so much water between us. John's brother Keith Hammond and his wife Lisa live on the island and work breeding and rearing the cattle. After successfully driving all 1,500 head off the island, the brothers treat the riders and their families to a barbecue at the campground nestled against the river.
Tanya, good to see you. You've had your Barbie dinner?
I have had my Barbie dinner, yep.
How was today?
Actually, today we had a very good day. We didn't have too much drama. We had a little bit of a go there at the crossing when the cows thought they might go back, but we managed to change their mind, and really we didn't have to work overly hard, which was good.
What's your history with droving? Yeah, I know that you've been doing it quite a while.
Yep, no, I've been doing it for a little while now. Been over a few times, yeah, between here or the West Coast, taking cattle to Sandy Cape. Been doing it for probably 30 years.
It is an art, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, at the end of the day, it's like you need to be able to read the cows. You need to know before they're going to do it to stop them doing it, because, I mean, prevention is better than cure, really. And so I suppose over years you learn to read the stock and you learn to read your horse and the dogs and whatever.
You and Stuart and your relationship is pretty closely related to horse work, isn't it?
Well, that's our life. I mean, as from the day we was married or before, we have been involved with stock, horses, dogs, sheep, whatever, and we've always worked together on a daily basis, so luckily we don't fight too much.
What do you think it does for your relationship? Because there are lots of people in the world who don't have anything like that kind of a connection through working with animals and each other and moving big numbers as well.
Well, I guess in our case, I believe that because we've worked together so much, I don't have to ask Stuart to do anything. I've only got to look at him or know where he is, and I know where I need to be. So it's just like you just learn, they're just an extension to another hand, because you know that hand's going to fix that while the other hand's doing the other bit. So we've got that close bond, I guess, that we both know what we're doing. If you have a bad day at work, you don't, it doesn't go home, stays in the paddock. You learn that very early.
Well, what about you, Stuart? What kind of an impact do you think working together has had on your marriage?
I think it's had a good impact. It's really probably brought us closer together. We don't have a family, so our dogs are and horses are our family. And it's just been able to, read. Like, we can be half a K away, but we know what each other's doing because it's that sort of thing. And it's just, made us stronger, whatever we do. And like Tan said, what happens outside, like, we don't take it home. We learnt that from the beginning, and just don't take it home, and that works, and keep that all the way through.
Do you think there's a bit of a link between how to leave and work and how to move stock?
Well, at the end of the day, you can't force an animal to do what it doesn't want to do. I mean, if you're riding a horse, let's face it, they're a fair bit bigger than we are, so they want to do it because they've got a respect for you and they like you or whatever, and you treat them right. And cattle are the same. You know, cattle, if you treat cattle right, you don't have to bash the living daylights out of them. You know, look, you go to the gate and sing out to them. I mean, all my cows, Stuart tells me they're too fat and too sport, but if I go to the gate and sing out, they come. So, you know, I very rarely have to put the dog around them because they like me and they want to come, you know. So it's just a matter of treating everything right, really.
Lessons for life. What about you, Stuart? What do you reckon? There's some truth to that?
Yes, there's a lot of truth in it. And like I told Tam when I married her, I'm going to show you everything once, and after that she learned very well, so I lay my tiles very nicely, I think.
Well, what can I say, you know?
You've taught him everything he knows.
He's the boss, but as long as he asks my permission.
I'm Keith Hammond, one of the owner managers of Robins Island.
I'm Lisa Hammond, Keith's wife.
Well, we're fortunate because at low tide, we can drive vehicles across or take fertilizer or lime sand or... So logistically, it's not as bad as an island that would be further offshore.
It's a unique breed. Does it have specific requirements in how it's reared? Is it less hardy than, say, the Angus cattle or the Shorthorn?
That's a good question. I would say they're a very hardy animal. They don't tend, even though they marble, have a lot of intermuscular fat, they don't tend to have a lot of subcutaneous fat or outside fat. So they're a little leaner animal.
They did. They looked really lean to me, but that's because I'm used to seeing these...
You're looking at Angus.
Angus running around with an inch of fat over their body.
Mm. And they've got skinny legs and little sort of...
A different type of animal than we've traditionally bred in Australia. For a Western cattleman, unless you really go to Japan and see how they do it and understand what the cattle, how they perform and the markets that are there... It's very hard to compare.
So here we are. The draft is underway. Gary, why don't you talk me through what happens here?
Well, what we're doing now is taking the calves off the mothers, take them off their mothers now, and within an hour, the mothers are going heading back to the island before they realise that their calves aren't with them. So it gets us over all the bad spots, through the rivers and whatever, before they start to think, oh, where's my calf? And by then, they're virtually back on the island. It makes the job a lot easier.
And how do you think things are going today? Are the conditions good for this kind of a draft?
Wonderful. You wouldn't get a better day. It's a day in paradise. And what they're doing now, we've got probably half a dozen men, and they're just gradually walking through and cutting the calves out by foot, which is quite a good sight to see. You've got to be pretty fit.
Yeah, and very nimble.
And very nimble because...
cow sense.
How do you know if someone's got cow sense?
Well, you see them eating grass, a lot of them.
So the calves are drafted and we're ready to go. Everyone's saddled up and ready to ride out. What happens next, John?
Oh, well, we think the best strategy is to put the horses on the beach and to bring the cattle out of the paddock with the two bikes, because we have a bit of a risk. Once they hit the beach, they could sort of follow around the coastline and end up in the campground, and I don't think the campers want them going through their tents. Yeah, no, we should be able to control them very well. And yeah, we'll see how well they go, but I think they'll travel pretty quickly to the river today. We'll have to actually probably get someone in front to slow them down a little bit, because it's a lot warmer today. And of course, once they get in the Montague River, when we get there, it'll probably be 2 hours before low tide, so they'll have a little bit of a swim, which will cool them off, and then another hour's walk to the crossing, two more channels, and then we'll shoot them across to Robins Island for a bit of a spell.
Making their way along the beach, none of the cattle break away and head for the campground, as John feared they might. It's a smooth crossing back to the island, with every cow and calf accounted for. And while it might be hard work, these riders and stock workers are already looking forward to the next Robins Island saltwater muster a year from now.
That special report from the Robins Island Saltwater Muster in northwest Tasmania from Jane Ryan. Sounds like she and the driving team had a lot of fun. Check out her wonderful online web feature at abc.net.au/rural. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, Miriam Hall joins an exercise class in outback Queensland, and we find out how chooks keep their cool.
We've got to try and do what we can to keep the chooks cool. So there's fans, there's air conditioning. Then we do put sprinklers on the roof as well to keep that side of it cool.
The mercury's sitting well and truly above 40 again today. And like these chickens, I'm finding it hard to find a cool spot. G'day, I'm Brett Worthington at the Wollong Family Farm, just outside Mervyn, in the very hot northwest Victoria. Elaine and Robin Henschke set up this free-range egg farm just last year, supplying local restaurants, bakeries and farmers markets in the Mildura area. Now, business has been great since they opened up, but this run of hot weather is causing quite a few headaches. You see, unlike humans, chickens can't sweat and die very quickly from heat stress. And that's why there's all these fans, air conditioners and sprinklers on hand to keep the chooks cool and happy.
We have sprinklers in the block as well, just to keep the pasture and all that going, so they can have a good scratch around. And yes,
and there's a bit of shade here in the paddock with a couple of citrus trees. By the looks of it, they look like they're quite popular spots by the looks of it.
Oh my word! And we have water containers under them as well, and that's why when we sort of have the sprinklers going in the block, it just cools everything down and cools the soil down as well. Because as long as their legs are cool, usually the chooks are cool. They lay in those nests there, and as they lay, the egg rolls down onto a belt, and that belt brings them through to the accumulator, which is run by a motor, and we have that on a time clock. So in their main laying period, we have that going. Then it might shut off for a couple of hours, and then it'll switch itself back on again and bring the eggs down again that have been laid and are just sitting on the belt. Robin starts collecting from 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, and then all through the morning he comes down about every hour or so just to collect all the eggs out here. Otherwise you get too much of a build-up, and that's where you get your broken ones and cracked ones.
Which is the last thing you want.
That's right, that's right. But needless to say, we do get them.
So we've just ventured into probably the best place to be on a 40-degree day, which is the cool room here. What's this room and what goes on in here?
This is our, what we say, is our egg room, our packing room. After Robin's collected the eggs, we bring them in buckets. Robin puts them on the conveyor belt. And that then goes into, and it's all done by weight, and they go to their sizes. And I pack from there, whether it be on trays or into pre-packed one dozens. Some customers do come here. I've got restaurants, I've got bakeries, and I also do farmers market just to get rid of any excess eggs, mainly the jumbos, because we sort of don't really have an outlet for the jumbos.
So when we talk about a jumbo, what are we talking about in terms of those kind of eggs?
It's quite a large egg. It's probably between a 70 and an 80 gram egg. where the normal size is around the 60. So there is quite a bit of difference.
What's the feedback been from people in this part of the world when you've started setting up at the farmers markets and telling them that eggs are being produced here?
Oh, they were just so excited, just mainly just to have the free-range eggs and to have the fresh eggs, because they found in the supermarket, she didn't know how long they had actually been in the supermarket. It's exciting, and particularly for the people that buy the jumbos, because it's exciting for them when they come across a double yoker, because you don't usually get a lot of double yokers, and yes, people really enjoy that.
Naughty ones usually lag behind so they can stay at the back and cheat the lunges.
Yep.
Like I'm doing right now.
Yes.
Keeping fit and healthy, we all know we're meant to do it, but actually getting up off the couch and exercising, well, that's another story entirely. So why do I find myself doing body lunges down the Flinders Highway in northwest Queensland, dodging semi-trailers and roadkill?
It's not every day if you're a trucker you get to drive past and see a bunch of women doing lunges.
Hot-looking women doing lunges.
Sorry.
How we are.
A bunch of babes, sorry, doing lunges.
Hello, I'm Miriam Hall, with you in the tiny town of Prairie, a couple of hours' drive west of Townsville, where a group of local women are working out at their twice-weekly fitness class, looking after both their physical and social needs.
How are we going, Miriam?
Good.
I see that you ended up in the naughty corner.
I'm still lunging.
That's what they all say.
I run Short Circuit. My name's Pauline Mustin.
And everyone seems to call you Shorty.
Yes, it's kind of stuck.
Yeah, because you are short-statured, we'd say.
Yeah, we'd say that. And I really like the ring to Short Circuit. I think it really fits. Where we are here, I think it's really important because we're in such a remote area. This class has been going for 3 to 4 years now, and we get a lot of women travel down from Huandon into properties, and we've gone up to doing it 2 days a week now, and it's a good opportunity for the ladies on the properties to come in, and we have a little bit of a social gathering, and we're getting fit at the same time.
It's probably more than a little bit of a social gathering, I'd say. It was quite a gossip session going on when I got here, and in the middle of the class, everyone was looking at dresses and fascinators. So is that an important part of what you're doing?
Oh, absolutely. Because a lot of these women are isolated, so until they come to town to go shopping or run into people that they see when they do go shopping, unless they go to neighbours for a party, they don't get a lot of chance to see each other, especially at the moment with the season that we're in with the drought. To me, it wouldn't matter if I was just here by myself. I would still be exercising. But I just put it out there every week. I put a notice board down the park that we do the classes here for free.
4, 3, 2,
Why is it important for people to have an option like this when you talk about fitness? Why is it, you know about fitness, but I guess it's not a passion of everyone's.
No, that's true, but there is not a lot of access to equipment out here as opposed to Townsville where there's gyms and personal trainers.
When we were doing lunges, we were by the side of the road, and I just had this moment when I was like, this is quite surreal. I'm doing a lunge by the side of the highway. What's that like?
I guess I don't really think about it anymore, but
there was a dead kangaroo there. You probably didn't notice that either, but I did.
I did notice the dead kangaroo.
Certainly no shortage of complaints among the class participants, and if you were doing these exercises, you'd understand why. But ultimately, these women know just how important it is for them to keep fit.
I'm Michelle Fryer. I live outside of Prairie at Railview. You might do a lot of physical work on the property, but there's a lot of things you don't do, and as you can see, we do a variety of workouts. So we do cardio, we're doing weights, we're doing pump classes, we're doing everything. So it's working out those other muscles that I don't use at home.
It's funny because a lot of people who wouldn't know about property life would think, oh, it's very physical, it's very active. You wouldn't need to do extra exercise.
We don't necessarily sprint everywhere or get puffing at work. So you don't necessarily get a cardio workout. You might do some weights, but they're different. You're only using the same muscles all the time. So Shorty makes sure we use different muscles and give them all a workout.
It's not just about exercise, is it, for these women?
No, we get together, you can catch up on what's going on or what's happening, and sometimes it can be a bit of a fashion parade because someone has something new to show. But yeah, it's really good. It's much networking with each other, and just especially some of us that don't come to town very often, you can come in and see people.
Jackie Davison, I'm from Moonda Prairie. I pretty much just work on a cattle property the whole time, really, and we just take care of our cows and live the country life and survive on what we can.
And it's you and your mum?
Pretty much, yes. No, my dad passed away 10 years ago, so since then we've just been poking along as we can and do as we do. It's a good social life, you know. You come in and, because there's not very many social events in Prairie, so you come in and you see all the girls and Shorty works your bum off, and it's a getaway from, brings you back to reality sort of thing of what everybody else does in a normal day. On a property, you pretty much do the same thing every day, or you're going all the time, but it's not really strenuous exercise sort of thing. So when you come in here and you're doing things that you're not used to, you definitely get your workout.
And for Pauline, or Shorty, as she's widely known, it's satisfying work.
How have you watched these women change? I have seen their development and confidence grow in ways that a lot of these women are quite strong already, because they're throwing lick bags around the paddock, throwing hay around, but this class here works different muscles, and you can see them becoming more coordinated each time, especially now that we're doing these step classes where it's so structured. It gets a lot of people out of their shell. A lot of these people are quietly spoken, that generally
they live on properties.
Wouldn't come to this sort of class.
That must be a good feeling.
It is a good feeling. It's a nice feeling to take home at night. Makes me sleep well.
Pauline Muston running her short circuit exercise classes in the tiny town of Prairie, a couple of hours west of Townsville in North Queensland. And thanks to Miriam Hall for pulling on her gym gear to bring us that report. You're listening to A Country Breakfast. I'm Libby Price. Coming up, what next for Australia's largest fruit processor, SPC Admona, the biggest employer in the already economically depressed Goulburn Valley.
This morning, a fresh new lineup starts here on RN.
I'm Fenella Kernebone, and on By Design, with the Lunar New Year upon us, we look at how Chinatowns have evolved around the world.
Then at 9:30, join me, Michael McKenzie, for RN First Bite, when I take you inside a Chinese kitchen for food that will bring you wealth, happiness and a long life.
That's By Design and RN First Bite.
Your new Saturday morning lineup.
From 9 here on RN.
A shell-shocked Shepparton in northern Victoria is taking aim at the Conservative political parties for abandoning them in their time of need. This week, the federal government rejected a request for assistance from food processor SPC Admona to redevelop the company. With the country's largest fruit cannery threatening to shut its doors, the community has a lot of questions. Goulburn Valley reporter Warwick Long.
Listening to comments from SPC Admona, it's not hard to understand why the community of Shepparton in northern Victoria considered the federal government's decision a referendum on the future of their town.
All companies that continue to make losses are going to face oblivion at some point.
I just want to be clear, is that the ultimatum that you're giving these governments, the state and the federal governments, that if they don't fund you, you will close?
I can't see a viable way for SPC to be operating in the future if we don't invest this money, so I can't say it any clearer than that.
Dennis Patterson is a small business owner and councillor in the community. He describes the decision by Prime Minister Tony Abbott and his cabinet as a kick in the guts for the region.
We're probably at the end, hopefully, of a perfect storm. We've had 10 years of drought and we've lost a lot of our irrigation water down the Murray. We've had a historically high Australian dollar. We've had cheap imports. And this is hopefully the final leg of a horror strip.
Is it a hard or an easy place to do business at the moment?
Certainly getting harder. The Australian dollar's had an impact on everyone in this town. We keep getting told that it's a level playing field, but our playing field, we're sitting on top of a hill at present. It's been very difficult in the manufacturing industry, all in Australia, full stop. It is very difficult to do business online, Australian dollar with cheaper imports, etc. It's just a part of the perfect storm that we've been enduring.
What do you think the mood's like today as everyone sits down to the meals or discusses the issue with their friends in the street? What do you think the mood's like?
Everyone's disappointed, I'm sure. We'll wake up in the morning, the sun will still come up. We'll wake up and this region traditionally gets on with it, and that's what we'll do.
The Goulburn-Murray region is a staunch supporter of coalition parties. It is home to some of the safest federal Liberal and the safest federal National seats in the country. Now that the coalition has rejected SPC's request for assistance, many feel abandoned by the political parties they support. For a grower, Gary Godwell.
Well, politicians have let us down. They've let us down over a number of issues. And when I say that, I'm not talking about individuals. Certainly Sharman Stone has represented us extremely well. She's gone out batting for us very, very strongly. But government policy in general has let us down badly. And I really think it comes back to this ideology that they have that if an industry can't stand up, just let it fail. But what they're not looking at is the fact that it is bad government policy that has let our industry down, and they really have to wear it themselves.
Many in Shepparton feel like they constantly miss out on government funds for projects or assistance, no matter what the political party. There's been a push to upgrade the highway, get better train services, and upgrade its courthouse, which is falling apart and can barely run air conditioning on 40-degree days. All of which seemingly fall on deaf ears. David McKenzie is the chair of the Committee for Shepparton, a private group which has been established to act as a voice for the region and lobby for a better future. He says the region's used to not getting help from government.
Shepparton's always been a place that has been a private enterprise town, and we think of other regional centres sometimes and look at them and might get slightly jealous of what we think of the government handouts and the government largesse in those spaces. You know, we've always been a long, long way in the, you know, behind the pack in that front, and yet we've grown and we've been a dynamic, vital town. We have been, the committee has been corresponding with the CCA board and writing directly to its chairman, David Gonski, who knows the town, has been to the town in the not too distant past, and we're prevailing upon him and the board to understand what part of the social fabric, apart from just the economic fabric, that their business plays in our town, and to not take any decisions now in haste, but just reflect calmly on what the future may be.
David McKenzie from the Committee for Greater Shepparton, ending that report from Warwick Long. From one community crisis to another, this time brought on by Mother Nature. Coonabarabran residents are still recovering from a massive wildfire that ripped through their landscape 12 months ago. Houses, farms, a huge chunk of the Warrumbungle National Park were all incinerated by a searingly hot fire. Now, 1 year later, ABC journalist Sally Bryant has headed back to Coonabarabran to see how the community's managing.
It was around this time last year that Coonabarabran started taking stock in the wake of a massive bushfire which had held the town hostage for weeks. Coonabarabran had been an eerie place to be, with huge military-style firefighting operation both on the ground and in the air. The locals were thin-lipped with resolve to get through the crisis. And then, as the fire was finally brought under control, the community stopped running on adrenaline and started the long, slow process of recovery. The past 12 months have seen the community go through peaks and troughs as they come to terms with the horror of what they've been through and the legacy they're left with. The mayor of the Warrumbungle Shire, Peter Shinton, has been one of the hands at the wheel, helping to steer the recovery.
Look, I think it's going reasonably well. Some houses have been constructed. A lot of fencing has been done, you know, thanks also to the Mayor's Fund, which raised a lot of money for it, and to the Blaze Aid volunteers. There are still pockets, though, where people are still suffering hardship, and that's basically because they were burnt out in the first case, and when the first rains came, the first vegetation that appeared were weeds, and one of them being the darling pea, which has caused great stock losses in the area as well.
Because that is the other great irony in this story. Farmers who've been bitterly angry over the impact of a fire that started in the national park and wreaked havoc on surrounding properties, those same farmers now find themselves in a serious drought. Stephen Lill suffered very heavy losses of stud cattle, fencing, housing and other infrastructure in the fire. He's tired and dispirited after a very tough year.
I guess we've learned to live in debt now. You know, after the fire, we sort of had $1 million hole there and we thought we'd be able to possibly trade and work our way out of that. But with this drought and having to sell cows at $20 and $30 a head, it's a pretty hard way to fill a $1 million hole. Droughts are an act of nature, and you have to learn to live with them, and you're not in that blame mode. Whereas when a fire takes a lot of feed out, and a few of your cattle and houses as well, you do feel a little more angry about that which was preventable.
And Stephen Lill is not the only member of that community who's angry and upset about the fire. Many Coonabarabran landholders say the fire was mismanaged from the beginning and should never have escalated the way it did. The coronial inquiry into the fire has yet to return a report, and an upper house inquiry has just commenced in the New South Wales Parliament. Meanwhile, fire-affected local landholders have banded together and are lobbying for compensation. Proctor Morris was one of the RFS volunteers who first attended the fire.
I'm the secretary of the Property Owners Alliance, and I speak to a lot of people, and I know that there are a lot of people who are doing it tough. The other thing is that people say they understand, but until you've been through something and experienced something like this yourself, you cannot comprehend what is involved. It's a very personal thing because it impacts on you. Nobody else, you. And for somebody to say, oh, I know what it's like, well, I'm sorry you don't. Unless you've been through it, you don't know. With something like this, yes, there's help available, but people have to seek the help. It's not like in the RFS where we're not allowed to leave until we've been through it. And everybody deals with things differently. Simple thing like that poor dead kangaroo on the driveway. Mm. Just moving that, knowing that that animal shouldn't have died and did, is gut-wrenching, really. And you're confronted with it every day, because when you drive in the front gate, it's still there.
In the heat of it all, as the fire still raged, the state government appointed a fire recovery coordinator to pull together all the agencies who'd be needed to get the Coonabarabran community back on track. Steve Bradshaw is a retired former senior police officer from a rural background. He's well respected in emergency services and government circles. When he completed his contract with the government, Mr. Bradshaw filed a report on his conclusions from the fire, including a number of recommendations about the mitigation of fire risk. He says he's particularly keen to see if parks could manage the risk more efficiently.
My recommendation in relation to that was that a wildfire or a rural fire expert be appointed to audit what the national park does. And if that audit finds that the national park is doing all they possibly can to mitigate fire, that finding needs to be sold to the adjoining landholders and the community. Or alternatively, if the audit found that the national parks need to do more, then they should be allowed to go ahead and do more. Because at the time there was, I think from memory, there was 4.5 tonnes of fire fuel per hectare in the fire ground at the time, and I think that's pretty significant.
Meanwhile, the human side of the recovery continues, and everyone's story is a little bit different. People have lost their homes, they've lost their treasured possessions, so in some cases they've lost their pets, and they're amazed that no one lost their life. Michelle Rowland was devastated when her rental home burned. She lost everything, and even then she felt that she'd let her landlord down.
It was such a beautiful place. Mm. It was mud brick, it had a water hole, it was gorgeous. And I felt like I'd let him down too. Even though I know it was a catastrophic thing that no one had control over, you sort of feel like I was protecting that house. And I'd failed him in a way.
In the year since the fire, Michelle says she's been overwhelmed with community support to help her rebuild her life.
Of course, it's had its ups and downs. I would say the ups have been so many more. You know, there's so many clichés, I guess, that, you know, these bad times bring out the best in people, but it's just so true. Just complete strangers wanting to help you, and it's just unbelievable, and it's created so many new memories. Like, I have a painting in my lounge room now, and it was from an artist down in Canberra, and it's just beautiful. You know, I have quilts from all over, Tenterfield, Moree, you know, all these different organisations have helped, the Jockey Club, they bought my fridge, you know, so they're all the new memories.
However, Michelle had the contents of that house insured, and she has used the insurance money, and she scrimped and saved, and is now a proud homeowner, just a stone's throw from where her lovely mud brick house was burned. How does she see the rest of the community coping?
I think I'm one of the lucky ones. I remember at the time people sort of saying, oh, this is so awful. But I'd actually lost a child a couple of years ago. And I think once I survived that, I knew I could survive anything. So I knew I'd get through this. And with everyone around me helping me, I knew that it would be okay.
Michelle Rowland, one of the many Coonabarabran residents who suffered huge losses in last year's fire. Ending that report from Sally Bryant. Now, let's end today's Country Breakfast on a lighter note, because move over, Mr. Ed. Welcome, Alice the Talking Camel. Alice the Camel belongs to stockman Luke Thomas and is the star performer in his travelling outback show. And as Lucy Barber found out, it's hard to get a word in when Alice is around.
Meet Alice the Camel.
Yeah.
She's having a chat with Luke Thomas here at Gundaroo on the southern tablelands of New South Wales. Alice has one hump, she's tall, she has a cream-coloured coat and very beautiful long eyelashes. She's made for the stage. Today Alice and Luke are preparing for this weekend's performance of their outback show. Luke has bullocks, heavy horses, sheepdogs and camels, and he tells stories of how these animals used to be used in the outback. Alice has become the star attraction, though. That's because Luke has trained her to talk.
Uh-huh, yeah. She's always been a very vocal camel. You go to catch her and she talks, and you go to put the saddle on, she talks. If you're brushing her, she talks. And initially it was a camel who was a racing camel, and she won the Alice Springs Cup many years ago, and then she went to the paddock for about 20 years. And
how did you teach her to talk?
Clicker training. It's a technique that was initially probably used on dolphins, and it's based on food rewards and shaping the behaviour slowly. So
what is it, clicking the tongue or?
No. The click is it's a marker signal, and it tells the animal that it's just done the correct thing. Here it is. So, and then once the animal associates the sound of the click with the food, you can start to shape their behaviour, and it can take 500 and 600 repetitions to get them to do a behaviour that you're after.
And that's just a little button you're pressing on a little digit thing?
Yep, and then we couldn't shut her up. Once she discovered that there was food and talking and, you know, she could make a living out of this, she just is so noisy that we have to put her out right out the back of the show because she's just having a great old yarn. But we normally interview her during the show, and she talks about people like John Ainsworth Horrocks, who was the first explorer in Australia ever to be shot and killed by his own camel. Yeah, that was nasty, wasn't it? Yeah, the camel jumped up and the buckle on the pack saddle caught on the trigger of Horrocks's gun, and it blew the three fingers off his right hand. The bullet went in through his chin. It blew off his tongue. He never spoke about that. Yeah, the wounds turned septic. This was in 1846. And the wounds turned septic and Horrocks passed away.
And Alice, I've got a few questions for you. There's some rain forecast, hopefully, for this week for this area. What does that mean for farmers? Have you got thoughts on Saputo buying Warrnambool cheese and butter? And the GrainCorp takeover. What did you think about the Federal Treasurer Joe Hockey and his call on that one? Thanks very much for your time.
Alice the Camel, who doesn't have five humps, speaking there to Lucy Barber on the Outback Show in Gundaroo on the southern tablelands of New South Wales. We also heard from Alice's dad, so to speak, Luke Thomas. And that's it for a Country Breakfast for this week. If you'd like to take a few moments to take a look at some of the photographs taken for today's stories, indeed read some of the news, or even listen back to a podcast of the program, just head to our website, abc.net.au/rural. Great to have your company this morning, and a big thank you to our technical producer, Melissa May. On RN, I'm Libby Price. Talk to you next week.